It's a pleasure to have you listening to my show today. My sincerest desire for you to get something from it that will make your life richer, fuller, and in this time of coronavirus pandemic, safer. I am Reverend Wynn Henderson. As an ordained Christian minister and a retired medical doctor, I have a dual perspective to bring you content to solve problems in your life. Freedom from Addiction, Share Your Mission is the longest running, single-hosted and produced, spiritually based radio internet talk show in the country. It has been continuously running for the last 20 years. I introduce you to celebrities and non-celebrities alike who have something to say about the disease of addiction in its 30 plus different forms, and or about the importance of finding your mission or purpose in life and then acting on it. My guests today are Bernie and Charlie Siegel, and we are following up in part two because we had a technical failure on the last interview, which was May 15th. So, Charlie, Bernie, it's nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So what we're going to do is we're going to start where we left off, and the people who are listening today can go back, just scroll down on the podcast a month and get the first Bernie and Charlie interview. And we'll start after about 40 minutes of the first one. As you know, our guest today, Bernie Siegel, medical doctor, is a New York Times best-selling author of Love, Medicine, and Miracles. He's a lecturer, the founder of the ECAP, that's Exceptional Cancer Patients, and a retired pediatric general surgeon. He has been called a leading teacher of the mind-body connection and is the paternal grandfather of our second guest, Charlie Siegel. Charlie is a spiritual fiction author and poet, as well as a fine art nature photographer. His lifelong study of the martial arts is another facet of his spiritual practice. And like I said, Charlie is a grandson, and in fact, the oldest grandson of Dr. Bernie Siegel. So, y'all ready to go?
Yes. Let me mention something, because you mentioned your combination of medicine and religion. Years ago, in the 1970s, I shaved my head. Why? Because I had to. I just had this feeling I had to shave my head. It drove my wife and children crazy because I was already embarrassing them quite frequently. And they were wearing their hair down to their shoulders. Years later, I finally understood what made me do that when it was totally, you know, not acceptable and everybody thought I was a disturbed person and therefore talked to me about their troubles. But what Jung went on to say, and I was reading, he said the reason monks shave their head is called a tonsure. It's called a tonsure, and it's symbolic of uncovering your spirituality. And when I read that, I sort of wished I had been in therapy and understood myself, because every person I saw, from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross to many others, would always say to me, "What are you covering up?" And here's a symbol of uncovering. And because of all the emotional impact of being a surgeon and illness and what you can't cure and much of what's going on in the world today, and people are more understanding of it, I buried all that inside of me. And one portrait that I painted, because as one of the reasons I became a surgeon was to use my hands. I love painting and drawing. And as a relief of my pain, I used to paint portraits of our children and pets. And when they got tired of posing, I put up a mirror and did myself. And I talk about covering up. Imagine saying, yes, I painted my portrait, and you look around the room and say, I don't see it, because I painted myself as a surgeon in the operating room with all the garments on, cap, mask, gown, so you don't know who the guy is. And I learned that something, and I think part of what your program helps us do is to uncover what is within us. So it has benefits, not internal harm and causing diseases. And one more, I promise one more thing, then I'll breathe. there was an article I saw sent via the internet about the surgical journal that published an article on patients who were taught meditation, imagery, attitude about surgery, all kinds of things. And at the end, it said they spent one day less in the hospital and saved over $3,000. I was doing that 40 years ago and called controversial and worse, and written up in many journals because everybody thought I was a disturbed person to think those things would benefit patients. But finally, somebody did a study, because when I tried to get funding and studies done, everybody said, no, that doesn't make any sense. Why should that help people? And now, you know, I could talk for an hour about all the things that help people recover that are becoming more acceptable.
Well, Bernie, I've been on a spiritual journey and quest for 20 years, and looking in the mirror, I don't have much hair left either. I didn't cut it off. It just fell out.
Well, the reason Charlie and I came together was I felt how spiritual he was at his age, whereas I had to struggle to find that in me. Because I had called him about another book I had just written, No Endings, Only Beginnings, to get help on spiritual subjects. And after talking to him, it's like, hey, we need to put our own book together with our poetry and everything else, because all of what was within us was coming forth in our writings.
It's nice. It just kind of happened that way. As we were looking over each other's work, we found so many moments where things we had already written years apart, they were so similar, discussing similar subjects in life and spirituality, and even sometimes the same titles on different pieces we'd written. So to make a book together, that's, it's a conversation between us about life with our work alternating through it. It just kind of happened that way.
Yeah. One more thing I've got to say, why Charlie always impresses me. I mentioned this over and over again. The book that we put together is called When You Realize How Perfect Everything Is. But I said to him, since two of us wrote it, why did you put a photograph with one bird flying on the cover? Because it seemed to me there ought to be two birds. And his answer, of course, always enlightens me. And he said, that bird is the person reading the book. It's their finding their way. That's what the book is to help them do. And that touched me too, that we each need to find our way. And believe me, I read several books every night before I go to bed, helping me find my way.
Well, this is a great book. I've read it, and a lot of great poetry in it, a lot of great photographs in it. And we'll come back to the book here in a little bit, but let me get back to my notes from a month ago. And I can't remember sometimes why I wrote something, so you'll have to excuse me if I'm not spot on. But the first
thing happens to all of us.
Okay, the first thing I've got is I think Bernie said, we are not human doings. We are human beings. Did you say that?
I don't think I'd say human. You said we are not human beings?
No, I said, I thought you said we are not human doings. Oh, we are human beings.
Yeah, the two words. Sorry, I didn't hear the second. Yeah, that we're beings. I don't know how to put that into other words, but we're not here to just do things. I mean, I think of men in my office saying, I can't work anymore. What's the point of living? And his wife and children are sitting next to him. See, the wife understands that. If she had the same disease, she'd say, I can't die. I got a husband and children. And we have to realize it's about relationships. Yes, you do something with the relationships, but it's not the physical, practical, you know, doing something. I got to have a job. It's by being, you do something. You can teach others, help others survive, give them love, change their lives. And men, more often, as I say, are into physical activity, not spiritual.
I don't know if you've heard this, but some time ago, I read a study which said that the time in a man's life when he is most likely to commit suicide is the year following his retirement. Now, you know, that's pretty crucial to saying that your job is what your being is all about. And it doesn't have to be your job. In fact, I would say you should have a reason for living other than just making a paycheck. What do y'all think?
Well, yes. I mean, my comment is we're here to be God's right arm.
Okay.
God is intelligent, loving, conscious energy. Now, how's he going to do anything if that's what he is? See, that's like the wisdom and the knowledge. But you need tools. And that's why we're created in all sizes and all shapes. When you realize what's going on in the newspapers and in, you know, public life today. The place we're all the same is inside. All colors, all organs. I would say, I was a surgeon. It didn't matter who came into my office. If they had appendicitis, I knew where their appendix was. I didn't have to look it up because of their race or religion or skin color. And we have to realize we're a family, different, so we can recognize each other. Because if we, I laugh, because if we were all identical people, who the hell are you having dinner with? Who climbed into bed with you? You wouldn't know who anybody was if we were all the same. So we need to be different for identification, and we need to be here to repair the world. Because God said, if it were perfect, none of this would have any meaning. So we're here to be what I call co-creators. And when you get to heaven, I always forewarn people, and they say, how do you want to identify yourself when we introduce you to God? And the right answer is tell God his right arm is here or his child is here. Because if you say, I'm a New York lawyer, they say, come back when you know who you are.
Well, Bernie, I want next to move into something and tell about the power of creating. In my book, Freedom from Addiction 3, the therapy is in the last half of the book, and it's five parts. And one of those five parts is in creating, because creating builds your self-esteem, and you need a better self-esteem if you're going to be able to lick the disease of addiction in one of its 30 different forms. So I tell people to create every day. Now, what's your take on that as far, because I know that you're very creative. How important is creation to you?
Well, I never stop. My wife died a couple of years ago, but I didn't move out of our home. because one of the things I love doing is landscaping. We can talk to Charlie about that when I'm done because of all his photographs. And so I'm trimming trees, branches, mowing the lawn, digging up a plant, moving it to a new place. I even have crazy signs that I took home from the hospital and from roads where they were just lying on the side. So when people come up my driveway, they're totally confused. But I'm always decorating the world. That's a part of me. And I'd say if we all spent time decorating the world, trying to make it look prettier. I mean, just a crazy example. Our newspaper is delivered in the morning in a plastic bag. But I noticed that every now and then there would be new colored bags. So I began to decorate around our driveway where I have little posts with these bags, blue, green, yellow, orange. And I don't know, I'm happy that way. Now, most people would say, what are you doing? I'm just trying to make life prettier. And I've even done it on our road where they have those warning posts that you don't go off the road into a ditch. And the bags there. I just feel the world gets prettier when you have all these colors and designs and decorations. And if people want to think I'm nuts, that's okay with me. But it makes me feel better to do that. And I'd love, you know, to hear what got Charlie taking pictures of nature.
Yeah, Charlie, tell us how you feel about creating.
We're all a part of everything that's around us. That's part of how I've been brought up. And through my mom's side, we have a lot of friends that are Native American. And she has a very spiritual store, and we'll get Native American made pieces for the store from people we know. So I've grown up around a lot of that culture and that the idea and the way that the idea of like all my relations that you're a family member with nature, with the trees, with the animals, we're a piece of this whole great circle of life and of everything. So going out and being out in nature and looking at that, you can see these patterns and ways that we're all connected with everything. There's a piece that I wrote in the emotions chapter in a way, and it talks about some of these like these patterns and ways that you see, like the leaves drop or the trees drop their leaves and they decompose and go back to the earth to help that next generation in the same kind of way. Like when we go through something painful, we can let go of it, process it, have a lesson that we've learned from it that we can pass on to help like the next generation or people around us. So we see a lot of these ways, and it's they've done some great studies on how healing it is for your mind to be out in nature, but it can be healing for your soul and like just the way you think about yourself and everything too. So when I go out to do photography, for me, it's a connecting with that the greater truth and nature that's out there. And it's helping other people to connect with it that way. I want my work to be like a window that people can look at my work, and it's like seeing that truth and that beauty and nature captured like in one thing that they can take and have with them all the time and look at all the time and help them. Like even when you're not outside, you can still connect in that way. So I've brought back photography from all around New England area here in the United States, and then from Iceland and from Japan so far, that when you go and see these like raw natural beauty kind of places, there's a presence there that can be healing for all of us to connect with.
And let me say the benefit of that, literally, study done where scenes like Charlie is talking about were put on the wall of the hospital room. And in other rooms, they put up abstract paintings. The people who had scenes of nature hanging on the wall had less pain and recovered faster than the patients who had abstract paintings. And believe me, anybody listening to this, if you go into your doctor's office and they put you in the examining room and the only thing that's on the wall is what you're going to die of, you know, heart attack, cancer, diabetes, it drives me nuts when you go in and sit on the examining table and looking at all those things. What I would like and my doctor that I see now has that. A beautiful colored room, you know, blue or green painted, and nature scenes. So I don't care if I have to wait 15 or 20 minutes. It's like a meditation to sit in that room. And I'm feeling better and my blood pressure is lower by the time they come in. And people should speak up. If something doesn't feel right, let them know.
Okay, so we're going to move off of creation now, but just making one passing comment. Creation increases your self-esteem. The root cause of all addictions is low self-esteem. So if you create every day your self-esteem will get better to the point that sooner or later, you're not going to need your addictive behavior. And that's all I wanted to say about that. So let's move on. You said, Bernie, I think all addictions are a search for love and meaning. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, love is the most addictive thing that there is, really, because when you truly feel love, your body chemistry is changed. Love and laughter. I mean, laughter is easier to test, but literally, when you're in those states, your internal hormones are altered. And so you feel good, whether you call it euphoric or not. You can feel drunk when you're really loved. And I don't mean drunk in a negative way. I mean, it's like a blissful state that you feel. And when you're following your heart, maybe that's another way for people to understand. But when you're trying to please others, then you get into a depressed state when it isn't your choice also. He who seeks to save his life will express it, say, will lose the untrue self. Because if you store up what's within you, this is an old biblical message, that is negative and takes away your life. In other words, you give up your life to please others. My mom and dad want me to do this. What happens to you? You have more illnesses. I'll put it in another way. Again, a study of Harvard students. Did your parents love you? No. By middle age, 98% had suffered a major illness. Did your parents love you? Yes. 24% had suffered a major illness. So you see, what's making them vulnerable to illness, or why Monday morning has more attack, stroke, suicides, and illnesses? You need to eliminate what's killing you that you've stored up within you, the things you've done to make everybody else happy, and start living your life. And that again, as a doctor, got me where I am today, because I began to meet people I thought were dead. You know, I'd give a lecture and I'd see old patients sitting in the audience and I'd think, what? They never came back to the office. And I'd go up to them. I said, why didn't you come back? And they're not talking about me, because I always gave people hope. But they said, what's the point of going back? Everybody's telling you when you're going to die and what's going to happen. That was never anything they heard from me. But I said, well, what happened? And then they told me how they changed their life. And I could take the whole program telling those stories. But they went home and they did things that made them happy. Moving, changing jobs, getting pets. And the side effect was not dying. I think the best way of putting it was a landscaper who refused treatment because he said, it's springtime, I want to go and make the world beautiful. So when I die, I leave a beautiful world. 6 years later, he came to the office because he had a hernia from his landscape business work. And he lived to 91 and became my therapist. Again, about nature. We used to walk in the woods and he'd show me all the beautiful things that I would have labeled a weed, you know, but he'd show me little flowers and all kinds of little things. And he changed my life. I used to pluck things riding my bike or jogging and bring them home with me to plant in our yard because I'd see something pretty on the roadside. And if we all saw life that way, looking for the pretty things, noticing them, not our parents telling us what we're doing wrong and how we don't make them proud and, you know, everybody else criticizing us at work or anyplace else. What does that do to you? It takes away your spirit and your life.
Well, Bernie, let's move on to somebody that we both have read and made a great contribution to the world in his writings. And that's Viktor Frankl.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "To live is to suffer. To survive is to find meaning in the suffering."
Right.
"And what am I here for? I am here to be a loving human being and to contribute love to the world in my way."
In your own way.
Yeah.
Not somebody imposing it on you.
Exactly. Tell the audience who Viktor Frankl was.
Well, he was in the concentration camp, a Jew thrown into a concentration camp. And I remember, again, I started doing this work in the late 1970s with cancer patients. And I wanted to learn about what I call survival behavior. So I started reading the books written by concentration camp survivors and then carrying this forward to the cancer patients. I mean, things literally like being on the line where a German soldier was going to decide if you go to a work camp or the gas chamber. And you walk up to him and you say, "Ich liebe dich, I love you." And the person who wrote about this meant it. He said, "I love you." And of course, the guard looked at him and sent him to a work camp, not the gas chamber. And also that those people who were living in the camps, concentration camps, who again were helping their fellow prisoners, were more likely to survive because of the acts that they were performing and what they were doing for others. I mean, again, it changed their ability to resist. Even in a concentration camp, it gave their life meaning to help others. And I still have those books in my bookcase because they were an enormous help to me to understand how to help people have a will to live and a reason. And one doctor wrote for a medical journal because he was totally shocked when he and his community were thrown into a concentration camp and they were told, "If you can't work, a bullet through the head or we don't feed you at all." And he thought, well, all his patients are going to die. And as he watched them, he saw what their will to live did. I mean, his words were, being in the infirmary was death because you didn't get fed if you were lying in a bed in the infirmary. So he said their will to live kept them functioning and working and doing things. And for him, he just felt that this truth had to be expressed. And so he wrote an article years later for a medical journal, and they published it. And you, again, could see the will to live is a real thing. Part of what I was called controversial about, you know, how could it make any difference if you have a disease, what your will is? But believe me, your will becomes chemistry. Your will talks to your genes. What you imagine and picture becomes your future because your body believes what you're telling it in images.
If we get back to what you were talking about, that story, "Ich liebe dich, I love you." If the protesters today said that to the policeman in a minute, I wonder what the difference would be in the response.
Well, I tell people now to be a love warrior. Now, what does that mean? Love is your weapon of choice. So when somebody's screaming and yelling at you and you say, "I love you," they don't know what the hell to do with you. See, because if you read the stories in the paper, when does a cop get violent? When the person starts screaming at them and trying to punch them and cursing them. What if the guy lying on the ground had said, please, I love you. You're choking me. I love you. Please don't do that. Or a young guy who's pulled out of his car, you know, drunk and ends up dead. What if he had said to the police, I'm sorry I'm causing you trouble. I want you to know I love you and I admire you for all the things you do. They don't know what to do with you. And I've done this to violent people myself, you know, on the streets when you don't know how they're going to behave. My line is to say, I don't know what's going on in your life, but I want you to know I love you and I'm sorry for any pain you're going through. And they walk away. If they're young, I say, I'm sorry your parents don't love you. I want you to know I love you. And I have always had a positive response. Because I say it confuses people. They're used to the violence and then they'll fight back. And then if you have a gun, you kill the other person. See, and it's something else I always say we need to look into. Why are you a doctor? See, why are you a policeman? Draw a picture of yourself at work. I do these things with people. And you'd be amazed at how many leave out anybody but themselves. See, draw yourself at work, all the weapons you have, and no people. Then you're not doing it for people. I know doctors who show themselves sitting at a desk. There's no patient with them. And most of the paintings of doctors, and I mean these are artworks, where there's a terribly sick person and the doctor's in the picture, his chin is in his hand all the time. I'm thinking. Well, why don't you stop thinking and love the patient, touch the patient, be with the patient? So when we choose professions for the wrong reasons, that's why you get all the headlines. If we did it for people. Jung put it this way. The diagnosis helps the doctor, but it doesn't help the patient. For there, the key thing is the story. For it alone shows human background and human suffering. And only at that point can the doctor's therapy begin to operate. So you go to a doctor. Oh, I'm depressed. Oh, here's a pill for depression. Why doesn't he say, what's depressing you? Oh, your house burned down. Your family was killed in the fire. Oh, my. Tell me, how are you feeling? What's going on in your life? Not, here's a pill. And I can't get the drug companies to change their ads. Meaning, after it's, the person says, I'm depressed, the doctor says, tell me about it. What's going on in your life? Then at the end, it can say, here's a medication that will help you and we'll see you again to talk some more.
I remember, Bernie, back in the 70s, when I would see a patient, I would actually spend time talking to them, looking them in the eye. And these days, when you go into a general practice office or acute care facility and everything, they want to be in and out as fast as possible, 5 minutes if they can. So some of the time that they are working with a computer, laptop, yeah, or something.
Oh, yes.
You don't get the same kind of feel that I had back in the 70s. And I think that that is contributing to the morbidity and mortality of the patients overall.
Absolutely. That's why I was so happy to see that article in the, you know, Journal of Surgery, that somebody finally did that. Because you're talking to a doctor who's facing the other way, looking at the computer. It's just ridiculous. Now, you know, I just found this on my desk. It doesn't tell you, it says anonymous. Life isn't about finding yourself. Life is about creating yourself. And I'd say that's a wonderful way to look at it. What are we each creating? You know, a therapeutic person who helps others, listens to others. As Helen Keller said, deafness is darker by far than blindness. When we listen to each other, we help each other.
Well, creating yourself goes back to creating in general, and it's that whole thing of creating a new person in yourself that's more in tune and in touch with helping other people that makes you a better person.
That's right. Personal opinion. And you can keep being born again.
That's right. Okay, so here's the question. Why are people doing addictions that they know are no good for them? You said because they don't love themselves and do not have self-esteem. They have been brought up on guilt, blame, and shame. That's the problem.
Right.
Well, it's this low self-esteem that causes people to go out and look for addictive behaviors to make them feel better about themselves.
Yeah. I mean, the drugs, the alcohol make you numb. You know, so you don't have to think about what your parents told you. Because that's the biggest significant thing in the world. Growing up with love and the messages you heard from your parents.
Well, those messages from your parents, if they criticize you once, it takes at least 7 attaboys to make up for that. Mm. And you don't get a lot of attaboys. So therefore, your parents, as if they were critical of you when you were growing up for whatever reason, are going to find that they have a child with a low self-esteem, and having a low self-esteem, they're addicted to something.
See, it's about coaching versus criticizing. If you were the coach of a football team, you don't yell at every player, "Hey, you stupid, clumsy idiots. That's why we lost the game. Goodbye." You'd say, "Look, we lost the game because of these mistakes or errors. This is what we've got to focus on." That's a very different statement. Say, it's not you're a terrible person, but we've got to improve your performance. And then they can listen because it's constructive criticism. I got to ask Charlie. Charlie, you're, you know, still in that stage of your life, in a sense. What did you feel about the role of your parents in your life?
I see a lot of impact from growing up with, my mom teaches spiritual development classes and meditation, and growing up being like sitting, you know, as a little kid, I was like sitting behind them working on Legos and stuff while she was teaching. And then at a very young age, I started sitting in the classes and help her teach them now. So that, you know, being with that, being with like martial arts instructors, like coach type people in your life that like care about you and support you, is definitely a key thing. But it's, you know, like if there's a lot of people that don't grow up with love for whatever reason, and in that, like in those parents' situation, that like maybe they love their kids, but kind of like from within, and it's not such an express thing, such a nice situation. It's not like all hope is lost kind of thing for those people growing up in that situation. That's like where spiritual classes and stuff are sometimes a key thing. If you find like a practice or a path, that's a lot of why Grandpa Bernie and I wrote our book together, that title, that when you realize how perfect everything is, it really talks about the imperfections in life, and that those challenges and those difficulties, that's what's perfect about life, because they make you, depending on how you respond to it, they can make you stronger. They can make you who you are, who you can become. I sometimes refer back to the story of Buddha, that like he grew up in, you could say, like a perfect life as a prince, and, you know, rich and cared for, but always kept inside the palace walls. And it was the first time he went out in the town, I think he was like in his 30s, and he saw suffering for the first time, getting out of that sheltered life. That's kind of the opposite situation, where like growing up with love and care and then seeing people that don't, that's when he went and became enlightened and changed into being a spiritual teacher, because he wanted to help people going through that real world suffering. So we see sometimes that like the suffering itself can be something that frees you. One of my favorite Rumi quotes is that when the wound is the place where the light enters you, that when you work through that pain and that struggle, there are people that deal with addiction for a time, but maybe you can learn your willpower and your strength by overcoming it. And, you know, you find, like, if you don't get those attaboys, like you were mentioning, you find a way to grow it in yourself, that love and that strength, or to find a place in your life where you can have it in a better situation. I find that's a lot of how we respond to it that is the key. And to ask for help when you need it is definitely part of it too.
Right. It's, yeah, what you're saying, I mean, because that's in Judaism too. It's like the crack in the vase lets in the light, as you're saying. And it's, you know, how does a pain become a gift? How did trouble become a gift? Or as some patients have said, it's a labor pain, you know, helping me give birth to myself. But when you see it as something productive coming from it, it doesn't hurt as much either. And that's something that people need to realize. But when you're feeling, oh, I need an operation, or I have to do this, I'm being punished by God, everything feels worse. And that's something that really bothers me about religions and many so-called religious leaders. I won't mention names, but this is not something I made up, but in a newspaper column. Does God want me to have cancer? Not necessarily, but God may give you cancer to get you back to church. Because if everything's going well in your life, you don't need God anymore. So God gives you cancer. That blows my mind when I read that by well-known ministers. I love what Maimonides said years ago, at least 1,000. He said, disease is a loss of health, and we need to help our neighbor when they lose something, or if you lose it, you look for what you've lost. And the other was, if people took as good care of themselves as they do their animals, they'd suffer fewer illnesses. I mean, when I read that, I'm thinking, oh my God, we haven't come very far, because that still applies today. I know people who smoke outdoors to protect their pets. They literally don't want their pets to die, because one developed lung cancer in this family. And so instead of stopping smoking, they now smoke in the yard. So they're killing themselves while protecting their pets. That's what blows my mind. We need to love ourselves and love each other, reparent each other. Let people know you love them. I didn't say you like what they're doing or even like them, but you love them.
Well, guys, this is a great book when you realize how perfect everything is. If y'all have a copy where you're sitting, why don't you read me at least a short poem that you have in that book that has some kind of impact and set it up before you read it?
Well, I'll pop it open. And the page I got to, do you have a book with you, Charlie?
Yep.
All right, on page 34 is your poem, Stirring the Coffee. Opposite is mine on 35, saying a poem. I didn't have time for a poem this morning. My soul will dry up like the fall leaves. I must water my soul and nourish my spirit. Without nourishment, I cannot survive. Give me a poem. Bathe me in the divine. I want to live. Feed my soul. Breathe life into my spirit. Give me a poem.
When I hear that, I think, and I go back to creation. A poet is creating
right.
a poem, and as a result of that, good spiritual things happen to both the poet and the world.
Yeah, and all the pain I was having and needed a poem.
How about you, Charlie?
And I've grown up meditating, and I feel like that can be a key thing to help people. And there's so many varieties of meditation out there. But when you get more connected with who you are, like on a psychological level, and just like kind of getting in your body and feeling like this is you and you're part of what's around you, it makes a shift in things. And we can start to see like the lessons and the beauty and the simple things. And as I was developing my photography career and writing things, I worked as a waiter for a few years, and I was getting coffee for a customer at the place I worked at and was stirring it for them. And suddenly this like whole different view of the coffee came to me, like what it can symbolize and a metaphoric kind of message in it for us. And a few days later, I was waiting for my own coffee in Starbucks line and stood there, and I typed out this whole poem on my phone while I was standing there in line. And it's these messages that came to me while I was stirring a customer's coffee. So this poem's called Stirring the Coffee. It's in here in the, I think it's the emotions section of our book. Yeah, it is. The world turns and my spoon travels around the rim. As the coffee swirls, the ideas circumnavigate my head. May they find a peaceful place to rest as the coffee grows still once more. When the spoon directs the coffee around the edges, are we the spoon in control of the coffee, commanding our life and emotions? Or are we the coffee being directed by an unseen force driven down the path of destiny? Perhaps we're the warmth bringing steam to the afternoon air. Did you ever ask yourself, does the milk change the coffee, or does the coffee change the milk? Perhaps we do not only find peace, but peace finds us when we accept its place in our minds. Be sure to open the door and let the peace in when it knocks. As the coffee grows murkier, it fails to reflect the light surrounding itself. Perhaps as I grow clearer, I will fail to reflect the murkiness of the world. I can hope. I sip the coffee and greet its sweet aroma and warming presence. The coffee congratulates me on accepting its lessons before it has passed by. It asks me, will I take the responsibility to show others the way to see? It's up to them to choose the way I respond. It's not I who stir the coffee, but the spoon.
Well, that's very, very enlightening. Thank you for that. We're getting ready to ask the last question here. I'm going to ask both of you that question, and here it is. If you had only 15 minutes to live, what would you do with that 15 minutes, and why did you answer it that way?
It's one of the questions I'm always asking people, but most people say, oh, I call everybody up and say, I love you. And I thought, if I got 15 minutes to live, I don't want to be on the phone dialing or texting everybody. I want them to know I love them and not wait for the last 15 minutes. So if I had 15 minutes to live, I'd get a pile of ice cream and syrup and all kinds of things that I love to eat and just sit down and enjoy them. And the odds are, at the end of 15 minutes, I'll be feeling so good, I won't die after 15 minutes. Whether I'll get an extra 15 or 15 more years, I don't know. But that's the kind of thing I see happening to people. So I'd say figure out what your chocolate ice cream is. And when you have a short time left to live, go enjoy your chocolate ice cream. And think of it as a symbol. You know, what is your chocolate ice cream? It could be living somewhere, having a job, just all kinds of things. What you want to do all day, where you want to travel. Find your chocolate ice cream and go enjoy it.
And how about you, Charlie?
I like that answer. I would say probably like a meditation type of exercise to like get more fully inside myself. Sometimes we're living life outside of ourselves, and we need to be that, you know, thinking about others and caring and stuff. But sometimes in a negative way, we get outside of ourselves, caught up in thinking that like these things we have to do or like these emotions we're having are us. And when we can get back into that quiet kind of place, we can realize that, you know, we're more than that. These like emotions and things are just something that's experience that we're experiencing that can be there for a reason, but kind of passing us by. So in a time like that, I would say I would want to center myself and be like fully here so that I'm like the complete me in a way, all put back together in place, in a more centered kind of way.
Thank you for that. So Bernie and Charlie, how about taking a minute to tell our audience how they can get a copy of your book and any other contact call to action that you might have?
Well, if they want to look up my website and many, many articles I have there and other things, it's Bernie Siegel, SIEGELMD.com. And a lot of the things I've talked about, some of the articles are, you know, stored in the website and you can look them up. Even attitude, one I love is deceiving people into health. It's basically, I call it deceiving, but doing a lot of children's surgery, I learned that I could lie to children because it had a hypnotic effect on them to hear me say things, and then it benefited them. So I would tell them when I'm cleaning their skin with an alcohol sponge, they're really lucky. This is a new kind of little sponge that now numbs your skin so you won't feel the needle at all. And I can tell you, 80% of the kids would always say, "That's wonderful. Why don't the other doctors do that?" 20% would say, "I felt it." And I could say, "Oh, it was a bad sponge." But every one of them had less pain because of my lie. And, you know, calling it a lie, but it's a therapeutic lie. So that's why I say deceiving people into health. Our mind control what our body believes.
You're unlocking the power of their mind for all of it.
You know, the doctor and the parent can lie to the children for their benefit. Go ahead, Charlie. I'll stop.
That's a good story. Our new book, The One You Realize How Perfect Everything Is, you can get it anywhere like Amazon, Barnes & Noble, that kind of thing. I have another book I wrote before, and my grandfather's written 18 other books. So same kind of thing. You can look them up and get them. But if you want to look at my mom's store, it's wisdomoftheages.biz, B-I-Z. There's a page on there that talks about my writing and my photography, has some links to Facebook and Instagram, and I have a Pickfair store for my photography. And you can get our book on here at the store too, and get autographed copies and things if you want to shop small with it.
But let me mention another book of mine that just came out that is why Charlie and I got together. It was called No Endings, Only Beginnings. And I find myself always rereading what I've written because the wisdom gets into the book and I'm impressed by myself. You know, I say, wow, that's good. Because it's almost like you're in a trance when you're writing it and doing it. And so I keep reading and rereading to keep learning. And I can tell you, they're like instruction books, a guidebook, let's put it that way. It's not about criticism, it's about ways of living and the choices you have.
Helping you with a more positive perspective, a different perspective to help with things.
Well, thank both of you guys for being on the show today. You have exposed our audience to a lot of important stuff, and I hope they go back and listen to this over and over again.
Can I take one more minute? I'm reading a diary I kept in 1996. And I tell you why rereading my words. Here are two days, messages. If you think you're perfect, you don't expect much of yourself. Boy, that's not my problem. I expect a hell of a lot. Everyone writes books with the answers. So why is the world such a mess? Should we give out free books? And those are just things that I get such a kick out of looking, as I say, this is 1996. Here we are, almost 25 years later. I'm still enjoying the thoughts I had and why we started writing poems and everything else. So bring it forth, get it out of you, keep your journals, write your poems, and you'll feel a hell of a lot better and become a lot wiser.
I agree. So for everybody listening today, I'll tell you that my mission or purpose in life is to spread a message that there is a cure for all addictive behaviors. This is a spiritual cure, and the treatment program is profiled in my book, Freedom from Addiction 3. It's available on Amazon and wherever books are sold. If you meet three simple criteria, you will get well. I have two free resources where you can start your journey. The first, follow a link to my podcast, which is www.freedomfromaddiction.libsyn.com. Spell Libsyn, L-I-B-S-Y-N. And for more detail about the treatment plan, go to www.revwynhendersonmd.com. You could also follow me on Twitter. The account is at Hugo the Artist. You'll find inspirational and educational daily tweets. And so that's the program for today. And thank you guys for...
All right. And I would add, remember that the spirits that help you are not the ones that come in bottles.